Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 112, with guests Sam Robinson from Real Gospel and Gene Werder from Real World Theology. So, listen up, because we've got a really great show for you. On this episode, we talk the Magnificent Seven and God's justice. Oh, man. So, Sam, I think it's great because you get to see these movies oftentimes, like, before they even... Not only before they come out, before they... way before they come out, like, in America. And I feel like you saw this movie, it feels like a month ago now.
It does feel like a long time ago. I saw it... When did I see it? End of September? No, before that.
Oh, wow.
It was the 21st of September I saw this movie, so I've forgotten most of it.
Well, that in and of itself would almost answer a question, you know, which would be, did it stick with you at all? But one thing I'm interested in is, since you also, for Real Gospel, review things in basically the same manner that Real World Theology does, have you gone back and watched Seven Samurai or The Magnificent Seven, the 1960s, like Yul Brynner, Steve McQueen version?
No, I haven't seen either of them.
Okay. Gene, have you?
You got it?
No, I haven't, man. I really wanted to. I had some intention to rent Seven Samurai, but I have yet to see either of those.
Well, even if you would have rented Seven Samurai, you would have had to have nearly 3.5 hours to watch it.
I know. So, it's a long one.
Which I mean, I've heard nothing but amazing things about how, like, it's like one of the most breezy 3.5 hour movies that you like. It's so well paced, yeah. And like, it doesn't feel that way because it's so good. And in saying that, kind of tip my hat or tip my hand that says that I obviously haven't seen it either. I had the also best intentions of watching it before this podcast, but hashtag life. So we've all set the stage that says we're coming to the Magnificent Seven having not seen the original Akira Kurosawa film, Seven Samurai, the 1954 film, which is regarded as one of the best films like in all of history. We mm-hmm. haven't seen the Americanized Western version of it, which is also supposed to be a very, very good movie. The Magnificent Seven from 1960, again, starring, you know, Yul Brynner, Steve McQueen, and Charles Bronson, among others. So we're almost coming to this with fresh eyes, saying, mm-hmm. "What?" Kind of like, let me see why this was made. I'm gonna go see this movie, and I will, something like a light bulb will go off. It's just not a vehicle for us to be able to put Denzel Washington and Chris Pratt and Ethan Hawke and Vincent D'Onofrio and all these other great characters together for a end of summer kind of blockbuster. Surely there's something else here. But, ... I'm not sure I can personally say that. So what I'm curious about, Sam, is in your opinion, did we need a Magnificent Seven remake if this is all we got? Well, that's kind of a leading question, isn't it, since I said this is all we got? I'll just say, did we need a Magnificent Seven remake, or did you at least enjoy the film at all?
I did enjoy the film for the most part. I think it's interesting you're talking to me here in Australia, because for me, the Western is quite a foreign idea. Mm-hmm. Not to say that it's like that in America anymore, but I'm keen to talk to you guys about... you know, is that a true representation of West, you know, the wild, wild West of America, especially with the kind of race that is, like, the different races that are represented in this film?
Right.
To me, I kind of felt like the director, Antoine Fuqua, or whatever, however you say his name, was really trying to make a statement with that. So I'm watching this Western film, which is set in the past, that really doesn't have much of a plot, I think you'd agree with that. Like, there's not really a whole lot going on, but it seems to be trying to say something. I did enjoy it, though. I got lost in it, but I think, yeah, I left with a whole lot of questions.
So I like how you point out that, you know, the concept of the Western is foreign to you, especially with such great Australian Westerns like Quigley Down Under, which have really set the stage for Australia being the true Western frontier.
Yeah, sure.
I'm just glad you didn't laugh immediately about that. So what's curious to me is that it's gone from samurai to you know, the cowboy, and both of them seem to pull from the cultural ideas of the people who made the cultures of the people who made them, kind of pulling from their myths and their legends. And when you're curious about if it's like a representation of the West, I'm actually curious almost why this movie got remade, because when you look at Seven Samurai being made in 1954, there's still like that mythos, there's still that that romanticism of the samurai, like, you know, whatever it was 60, 70 years ago in Japan. Kind of like in 1960, there's still like this romantic ideal of the cowboy in 1960, which mm-hmm. we don't currently have in American society. And so I'm actually curious, and I would throw this out to you as well, Gene, thinking about American society, but Sam, in Australian society, is there a way that they could make a Magnificent Seven that would tap into some kind of cultural Australian thing that people would be like, oh yeah, this mythic or romanticized time in Australia's past where a type of person, or, you know, a misfit band could have been brought together.
Have you heard about Bush Rangers?
I have not, but I want
okay.
to.
Did he say the Bushwhackers?
No. I've heard of them. No.
So I think in the late 1800s, maybe I've got that wrong. Basically, back after white... So the history of Australia as far as white settlement is quite short. So, you know, about 1790, I think, is when... or 1788 is when kind of white people came to Australia. So we've got a very long Indigenous history. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very much people don't recognise that history, and it's very important that we do. But after a while, I think during the days of the gold rush kind of stuff, down in Victoria, which is a state where Melbourne is, there was a whole lot of gold fields and what we call bush rangers, who are just guys who would go around with like helmets on and armor and would just go and rob people, usually rich people or whatever. So there's a famous guy called Ned Kelly who you should definitely look him up. I think actually there's been a movie made. Yes, Heath Ledger starred as Ned Kelly. I'm not sure if that got released in America or not.
I'm trying to look it up right this minute. Let's see. But go on while I look it up.
Yeah, so Ned Kelly, so I've just looked it up too here, because my Australian history kind of happened when I was in the age of 11, so it's been a while. So there you go. So he died in 1880. So I was about right. And he ended up getting caught in Glenrowan, and he was hung. And that's how he got killed. So I think as far as a Wild Wild West story goes, that's probably the closest thing we have in Australian history. And I think, I mean, that would be a pretty cool thing to see on film. I mean, I think that happened. I think it was 2003 there was a film where Heath Ledger was Ned Kelly.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, it's got a great cast too. This is Heath Ledger and Orlando Bloom, Jeffrey Rush, Naomi Watts. They got some people.
Yep. So it was I think that was an Australian film. It hasn't really lived on here because it passed out of my mind. I don't even know if I've ever seen it, but But I think that's probably the closest thing that our history would have to the kind of Western you see, you know, a whole bunch of outlaws. And I think it's interesting looking back on bushrangers now, people wouldn't see them as typically bad guys. It's more kind of like those heroes who made wrong choices.
Like like a Robin Hood, the way you're describing it?
Kind of. Yeah, like, yeah, definitely.
Like yeah, so, outlaws with a heart of gold kind of thing.
Yes, yes. So the town where he was hung and caught and hung, Glen Rowan, is still a town, and they have a whole museum dedicated to him. So it's quite an interesting thing. But his convictions were for murder, assault, theft, armed robbery. So he was still a bad guy, but no, worth looking into. But yeah, it's funny. I hadn't actually made that comparison until you asked that question. Yeah.
Well, I would say that it would seem. It would seem silly to have an entire museum or dedication to this stuff, but we have like a Billy the Kid museum. You know, they're like, mm-hmm. Hey, there's this dude that went around and killed people and robbed people. Let's give him a museum because he was really good at it. You know? So, but see, that's the thing. I think there are times in our history where things, even if they're not pretty, can be romanticized. And I guess I just feel like as an American culture, and like I said, Gene, you feel free to jump in, but as American culture, I feel like we're almost past the Western.
You know, I'm glad you asked this question because it's something that I have actually thought of, because like you said, in 1960, when Magnificent Seven was originally made, the Western lifestyle, that Wild West, was definitely romanticized. And today it's not really to that degree. You still have a few Westerns coming out, and occasionally there's some really good ones, but you definitely don't have anything that you were getting in the 50s through the 70s. So I wondered why it was they were remaking Magnificent Seven and not doing a different type of adaptation of Seven Samurai. And I just got to thinking, for today's culture, in America at least, I think a Magnificent Seven type story could work pretty well with an inner city backdrop. And we know that Antoine Fuqua can do those kinds of stories. He did Training Day. Mm-hmm. So he's got some cred there. I mean, think about Equalizer. It's really similar to Magnificent Seven. It would just be the Magnificent One, right? Yeah. So
just the magnificent guy.
He can do those kinds of stories. And I think if you have, like, think about, so Luke Cage just came out on Netflix, and I won't give any spoilers saying this, but there's a repeated line in the first few episodes where someone who was the victim of some kind of violence is asked if they saw anything, and they said, no, I didn't see anything. And one of the detectives says, man, I should get that tattooed on me. I hear it so often. And I think with that kind of mindset, with the backdrop of the inner city, with what we have going on in society today, with Black Lives Matter, with police shootings, I think you could have the potential for a powerful story there in the backdrop of what's going on right now in America. Mm. So I think that, and that would be a brand new adaptation with Seven Samurai as your kind of your base of the story, and using that as a motivation to tell it. So I think that could be done. And so thinking about that, I'm just wondering why they just did another Western when, you know, nobody's really craving a Western right now, I don't think.
Well, and just so I can finish the notes here for my my script proposal that I'm writing, if you do this as an inner city remake. One, it's interesting because I don't think at this point the inner city is romanticized in any way, but I'm interested in who your seven are. If they're all just gang members, then, or former gang, like there's some former gang members, like who would you imagine, how would that work?
Well, they certainly could be former gang members. They could even be current fugitives or something like that. I mean, with what we have now, we have Chisholm, who is a legal peace officer. Mm-hmm. You know, he's got the authority behind him, and he goes out and he gets some people who are also fugitives. Vasquez, I think, was the name of the one. But then the others are just kind of well-known, legendary guys who've done something to earn some sort of reputation. So they don't even necessarily have to be people who are running for the from the law currently. It could just be citizens who come together. It could be, you know, a neighborhood deciding they're not going to just stay quiet. They are going to speak up. They're going to seek out somebody to help protect them because maybe the cops aren't doing it. Maybe the cops just ignore them, that kind of thing. I think the potential is there for that kind of story.
So Sam, can you think of anything, like any way that they could have made this film in a more current, current setting, current cultural climate that would have maybe been better than just throwing a Western together again?
Yeah. I don't know. I like the idea of, it's hard to say because I feel like because of the Western and like we were saying, Ned Kelly, there's something about outlaws in the past being these heroes, but I feel like outlaws now, we don't kind of see them in that way. I don't know. I think here in Australia, we love going for the underdogs, right? But if the underdogs are ripping people off and I just don't see that you can get before that. So I think I wonder why. I mean, I wonder if that's why you can get away with it with a Western. I don't know.
Well, so I guess it's interesting, and this partially goes back to something I think we were mentioning before the show, which is it's kind of about the stories we tell, because I think there's a trend that has kind of waned a little bit, but it's, you know, it's the people getting behind anti-heroes because we tell such good stories surrounding them. Mm-hmm. I think this is very prevalent, like, you know, people who do bad things, but maybe for good reasons, or who make bad choices, but, you know, they mean well, or people who are just really conflicted. So we can get behind them. You know, this is like we always mention, it's like the Walter Whites. It's the Dexters, where we're like, you know what, in a situation, I can kind of see why they made that decision. Not a good decision, but I'm still rooting for them somehow. I think if you take a person with bad enough actions and you tell a good enough story, then like I said, it creates almost a mythos around them where you can overlook some of the things. I mean, think about, like, there were probably not a ton of Ned Kelly fans, like, in the moment. There were, you know, especially people who thought they were going to get killed by Ned Kelly. You know, probably same thing with Billy the Kid. Or I actually think about gangsters when I think about this being remade. I think that, you know, that's a time that was a bloody, terrible time in American history. You know, like Chicago, you know, New York, like you have like the mafia, like all these things, when going on, people dying all the time. But since that time, I mean, not that in some shape or form, you know, gang activity, you know, mafia activity, you know, that kind of stuff is not probably still going on to more degrees than we're aware. The stories that we've told about them have romanticized them. Even where the bad guys died, much like when we tell, when we look at old Westerns and, you know, the guy we're following the whole movie dies, we have Scarface, you know, we have The Godfather, we have Sopranos, like all these films are starting to, and all these stories are starting to tell stories of really bad things and bad people. That we are like, oh, that life was so different and compelling. And I'm curious if that seems like where a remake to me of Magnificent Seven would fit perfectly. Time, because I think we're now that far removed, about the same amount of years removed from that being a major thing as from when Westerns were in the 1960s.
Right. Right. Yeah, that could work. I mean, I think one of the reasons that we see such attention being drawn to the anti-hero stories or the stories of the gangsters who are trying to set their life straight. We, and with Scarface, obviously that's not the case, but we want to see, and I think this could go to speak. I haven't put a lot of thought to it, so I just kind of shooting from the hip here. This could go to speak to kind of our inner, maybe our inner desire of what we want to see is possible. So we want to see these bad boys just throw caution to the wind. We want to see what that lifestyle is like without actually having to, you know, do it or live it ourselves. You know, mm-hmm. we want to see what the danger looks like. We kind of want to tease ourselves with it. But then on the other hand, we see stories of guys who are just really stand up citizens, really good character. You know, they're straight shooters, and the story has to be really, really solid. Otherwise, that kind of a character can just get really boring really quickly. But we love to see the more dangerous characters try to seek out redemption, try to get to that point where they are what we might call a boring character. Because we want to, I don't know, maybe it's that we want to know that people can kind of come back from being that deep in sin, that deep in just the muck and the mire. We want to see him come back from that, and we want to see stories that inspire us and that motivate us. Maybe when we're at really low parts in our life, we want to know that that can be done. And those stories that are told, we remember those, and we say, okay, this can be inspiring to me. So I think that can be, you know, in the Magnificent Seven world, I think that can certainly be used. I think that if you did that with every one of the seven, that'd be a pretty, from what I know of Seven Samurai, that would be a big change from those characters. I don't know if all the seven were outlaws or anything.
Yeah, maybe. I think, well, whether they're outlaws or not, I think something that I didn't hear you say, but I think would be applicable would be understanding the motivation, like understanding the character. And whether it's somebody who fits the anti-hero bill or we just are invested in the character enough to understand why they're making the choice they're making, either way, whether we're watching a redemption story or we're watching a justice story, we can be compelled by it. And I would not only say that I'm not the first person to point this out, but I would be remiss if I didn't point this out, that the Seven Samurai has not just spawned the Magnificent Seven and now their Magnificent Seven remake, but the ideas in the film of like a band of unlikely heroes coming together to, you know, fight evil with different motivations and different backgrounds and different pasts is something that from everything that I've read and was reported, it like there were not really movies that did this before Seven Samurai. You know, maybe someone told this story, but people weren't putting this on film. And so if you think about that influence, even though it's not tapping into the mythos that I was kind of asking about earlier, just you know, as a curiosity exercise, we see this all too often. We see this a lot, even currently, because you can, if you apply it to the superhero genre, we to a certain degree have just described Avengers. We have we can blame Seven Samurai for Suicide Squad.
You can see it forming together in the Netflix series that Marvel's doing with Jessica Jones, Luke Cage.
So we get it a lot with superheroes. I mean, especially, I think probably the best example and the most direct example would be Guardians of the Galaxy, also starring Chris Pratt. So, but, you know, there's a lot of movies where this kind of thing happens. I think even a film that came out earlier this year, The Secret Soldiers of Benghazi, has a little bit of this. You know, people who are like, we're probably going to die, but this thing needs to happen. Let's come together and do this. Heck, Pixar did this in A Bug's Life. You know, so this is something that has been, you know, a band of misfits banding together to fight, you know, some greater evil is something that we see all the time. So what I'm curious about, and I would love to hear your thoughts, Sam, is what is it about A Band of Unlikely Heroes that audiences seem to love? Because like I said, this is something we see in many different forms in many different movies.
I guess it's easy to say that they're not perfect. And they're always sticking it to the man, right? It's an American term, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't know. I just feel like, especially with this film, I mean, Bogue, like, who he's set up as the guy you want to hate.
Yeah.
Isn't he? Like, you just can't wait for him to just die, which is a terrible thing to say. But it's kind of like, you know, you're watching the scenes towards the end of the film where it's just like everyone's getting shot. And you just think, why is he still there? And he's not fighting in the climax.
Right.
I think that's part of it. Because, you know, these guys aren't perfect, but at least I don't hate them as much as I hate Bogue.
So is that maybe reminiscent of what Gene was talking about earlier, where we're almost projecting ourselves, like we need to hope that imperfect people can come together for a greater cause?
Yeah, I think so. And I think as well, like I watched this film and I had no idea why they came together. I thought that was really not well explained. Mm-hmm. They just kind of just right. gathered together bit by bit, and they, like, I couldn't work out what the motivation was. Which I think,
yeah, I would agree,
made me less feel as though I was connected to them and rooting for them, because I couldn't tell what their motivations were. But I mean, their goal was to defend this town, and who knows why they wanted to do it, but at least they're going to do it. So that gave me enough to want to like them.
Did you feel connected to any of the seven? Like, were any of them developed enough, like, specifically?
Of the seven, I think Denzel, his character was quite... I mean, Denzel and Chris Pratt, for sure. But there was just, some of the others didn't really get a whole lot of airtime. And I couldn't work out, like, certain people, like the big guy with the weird voice, like, was he just there for laughs?
Well, I mean, I'm a big fan of basically anything Vincent D'Onofrio does now, I tend to be a big fan of. So I was personally enjoying it.
He was there to fill the scriptural reference quota.
Yeah.
Okay. There was a little bit of that, wasn't there? Like, yeah.
So even though we don't know a lot about, so that was Jack Horn, Vincent D'Onofrio's character, who had like the weird voice and was oddly kind of quoting scripture. Like, he's a character that I don't necessarily need. It's an example of a character I don't need a backstory for, because his personality tells me everything I need mm-hmm. to know about him. Mm-hmm. But I would, and in defending him, I turn a 180 and still am not pleased with almost all the other seven.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, like, I feel like Sam Chisholm is like doesn't really have a decent, like, a clear motivation that we're made aware of until kind of the end, but then the climax of the film I don't really think pays off for that. And so I'm still not really sure what his goal was or how he convinced anyone to do this. Like, we could tell there was something between him and and Goodnight Robichaux, like, maybe that would endear them to each other. But
did you guys catch the, it was in the scene where Goodnight was deserting them the mm-hmm. night before. They knew that Bogues was going to get there. Did you guys catch what they said to each other? Because I didn't catch until the second time that I saw it. So Goodnight is preparing to leave, and Chisholm catches him as he's leaving. And he kind of confronts him and like, you know, hey, you're running from your past. You're running from things. He says that line where what we what we lose in the fire, we get from the ashes, which I think is a really cool line. But then Goodnight says something in that exchange that gives us just the smallest bit of the background between the two, and that is that apparently Goodnight was a soldier in the Confederate Army, and Chisholm was a soldier in the Union Army, and somehow Chisholm saved him, showed him mercy, and brought him back or something. And so you were talking about why all these other seven weren't coming in. I feel like Goodnight probably felt a debt to Chisholm that he was trying to pay off, but the kind of the ghosts of his past, what he did in his past, killing people, being the sharpshooter that he was haunting him so much that he couldn't face it. He couldn't deal with it. So he couldn't repay this debt that he felt that he owed to Chisholm. So his answer was to leave. Of course he comes back later, but in terms of background, that's like the deepest that we get. And it's only an inkling, and it's enough, I thought, to get me much more interested in Goodnight and kind of puts a new light on him returning. Because when he leaves, you're kind of like, okay, he's coming back. He's going to jump over some wagons on a horse and shoot a bunch of people, and he does. And so you know he's coming back, but then if you know that background, it makes it a little more important. And all the other guys, like what's Chris Pratt's character's name? Spacing on it.
Josh Faraday. Faraday.
He just wants money, it seems like. Like Chisholm bought his horse, and he's like, hey, we're going to get paid all this bag of money for this, and he just goes along. We don't really get anything out of him. And Vasquez, another line I really liked is what Chisholm said to Vasquez, because he has a bounty on his head, right? And Chisholm has the warrant and stuff, and he shows it to him. And Vasquez says something like, are you going to turn me in? He says, you know, no, I want you for something else. And I think he asked something like, will this free me? Will this set me clear? And Chisholm says to him, there'll still be a lot of men after your hide once this is over, but I won't be one of them. And so I think you have a really neat image there of a level of forgiveness from Chisholm, but more out of necessity. He needs him to complete this task he has. But then the idea of just because Vasquez is going to do something good here, he's going to protect people that need protection, he's going to protect the oppressed, doesn't negate the things he did in his past. So his good works don't cover up his bad deeds from the past. And I thought that was a good little image there of, you know, we kind of works-based salvation doesn't work even in the Wild West, right? so just him doing something really good for these people, he still has something he has to atone for.
So I'm seeing some of these connections, and I felt some of these connections, but I still feel like it was the bare minimum.
Oh yeah, I agree.
And that's my problem. Like, I want to really care about these characters. And Sam, you know, you're saying that Chisholm had some background, but maybe let's put it this way. Of the seven, Sam, who is your favorite?
Oh, I don't know. I liked Billy Rocks. I don't know. I think he was definitely underused, and I didn't really know why he was there, but I liked the way that he fought because it was different to everything else. Yeah. You know, when everyone else is shooting. I don't really know. I wanted to really like Joshua Faraday, Chris Pratt's character, but I felt like he was just Chris Pratt.
Yeah.
You know, the comic relief, and it didn't fit too well for me. I don't know. What about you guys?
Well, let me ask you on Chris Pratt. Do you think that was a problem, just him being Chris Pratt? Because one of the reviews I read said, and maybe it was yours, Sam, I'm not sure. One of them said that it was like he couldn't decide between being Andy Dwyer or Star-Lord. And you kind of, once you put it in that light, you kind of see it in some of his lines. Do you think that's a problem, like us seeing Chris Pratt there more than we see a character?
Yeah, perhaps. And I think like that makes me wonder, because he's the star of the moment, and getting Chris Pratt in your film is just going to get right. people to the movies,
right.
whether that's why he's there rather than, you know, and then even him being there means that he has to do the comic relief character because that's
what that's true.
I mean, I'm a huge Parks and Rec fan, and Andy Dwyer is one of the best characters ever created, I reckon, but I don't know. I think he's gonna really struggle to do anything else. I mean, but, you know, other comedic actors have managed to do it in dramatic films, but, yeah, it seemed like the character was definitely suited to that.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that's what I'm curious about when you ask that question, because that doesn't really bother me. Like, I feel... Well, it can bother me, but Chris Pratt hasn't bothered me yet because I feel like the roles that they brought him in for are because they know he is the character that they wanted. So most of the problems I have with Faraday's character in this film have to do with how they wrote Faraday's character.
Okay.
Not because it's Chris Pratt saying the lines or anything like that. I think they got exactly what they wanted because that's kind of how they made it. Well, like I said, it's a little bit indicting, and I wish it wasn't this way, but it seems like that's how they get another name that's going to have box office appeal. You know? Like, yeah. Like honestly, when you put Denzel brings a particular crowd. Chris Pratt brings a different crowd. Ethan Hawke brings an even more different crowd. Like you are putting these people together, I think, for a specific purpose, not because it's the character like you envisioned when you wrote it, but it's the studio saying like this touches the most demographics.
But do you think they're trying to do too much? Like really, you know, the last few films that Antoine Fuqua has made are just like, you know, shoot 'em up action flicks.
Yeah.
And so that's, I feel like this is, it's that, but at the same time, it's trying to get this kind of comedic edge to get that extra audience. And I feel like it just, that makes it a little bit muddled.
Well, I think in, when you have a band of misfits, you have to have someone who's, not just cynical, but a little bit, not a prankster, but just who's got a smart mouth, you know, who is going to be that person who's always got something to say. And, like I said, I haven't seen the 1961, but I got to imagine one of them has some smart aleck things to say, about their situation. Obviously not like in a modern comedy kind of way, but in, you know, comedy right. for the time. And I would miss it if that wasn't in this film. I do think the type of comedy doesn't necessarily fit with the genre that they were going for. Because one of my positives about this film, and I was going to kind of have it as like my final thought, but generally, one of the things that I liked most about the film was that it was more of a Western than I thought it would be. Like I honestly thought this would be, you know, the Equalizer in the West. And while there are some aspects of that, it was actually more Western than it was, you know, big budget blockbuster, action film. There was not near enough uses of, extraneous uses of like dynamite and someone who's come up with like the thing bigger than dynamite. And I know they had the Gatling gun scene, but this is a far cry from like Wild Wild West where,
sure.
you know, the where the West is just a backdrop for like a modern action film.
But they paid a lot of homages to typical Western tropes. Like one thing that jumped out at me was how everyone got shot. You know, they get shot by a handgun and they're thrown back 10 feet. Yeah. They're falling into graves or through windows, that type of thing.
Yeah. I mean, and when you enter that genre, it makes it very difficult to put modern comedic stylings on top of it. I feel like it sends mixed signals. And that was my biggest problem, with probably, like I said, I don't think that's Chris Pratt's fault. And maybe I just have like a budding man crush on him, and I'm defending him for no good reason. But I didn't, like I said, it was the tone in which they wrote the character. And I think they got exactly what they wanted. I just don't think it worked very well. Well, I don't want to run out of time before we hit on a couple other things. Because I really am curious about some things that we've kind of danced around. And so I will say this, that I like the way that JR puts this in his review that he did for us over at Oral Theology, when he said, the film feels like it has something to say about God. And then he goes on and then says, but it all just evaporates. So does the film have something to say specifically about God? I mean, because JR even points out there seems to be some kind of centrality with his church as like a set piece in the middle of this town. So Sam or Gene, you know, did either of you guys feel like the film tried to say something, or did it just happen to mention things?
Well, I felt like I had the same sense on the church, especially, and there was something about it being how it was used in the beginning and then at the end of the movie that just felt symbolic for something else going on. So I was trying to pay extra special attention to that on my second watch, but nothing really jumped out at me. I was trying to kind of tie it to some type of redemption with this town and what that building means to them. But the only thing I could really get out of it is that what the church is used for at the beginning and at the end, I think could represent a revival of sorts. So, you know, if something is redeemed, it's typically used for negative means from its origin or from the start, and then you flip it and use it for godly purposes. Well, with the church and with the town, you know, allegedly you would say that it started good, it started fine, it started as a godly place, and Bogue coming in just dirtied it all up, right? He was the sin presence, like the, you know, the major sin presence, and him coming into the church at the beginning and equating God with capitalism and capitalism with democracy and that, it kind of trying to say that's what he was doing. So because he's doing it, God's on his side. He said, he even used scriptural languages. He said, phrases. He says, I descended into this valley and cast my gaze upon it. That's part of his opening monologue there. So the way he used the church and then, of course, burning it, and then the way that the seven used it at the end, I think revived it to be something that was a beacon of hope of sorts for the town. And that it was still standing, and the town is still standing, and these seven are still fighting for them, and there's still hope there. And that, as far as symbolic imagery, I think that's kind of all I got out of it. And that's kind of like surface level stuff, I feel like. And then you could even go into, I think, the fact that Chisholm is pursuing Bogues into the church, and they both get up on the pedestal at the front, and he ends up kind of choking him. And there's some imagery there, of course, because Bogues is praying at the time, and Chisholm even pauses for a moment. He says, I want you to pray with me. And I was kind of like, that would be, if we were doing come on moments, that'd be mine. I was like, what? Hold on. Are you Jesus juking us right now? Are you asking him to repent after you just killed these 200 people? So for a moment there, I was like, okay, gospel's going to happen, but no, it doesn't.
but spoiler alert, it doesn't. Well, that's the thing about that. It was very, and I don't want to necessarily change the topic, but it was almost infuriating because you have a man who at least tangentially kind of seemed to have some kind of faith, basically mocking the idea that someone would pray to God because they're bad. And I was like, oh man, that's just bad. Like, that's bad theology on a lot of sides, you know, thinking back to why Bogue was probably praying in the first place. But I mean, I guess we probably do the same thing. I'm sure there's plenty of pastors or versions of Christianity that we look at and we hear them pray and we're like, I bet God's listening to that. So maybe I shouldn't be quite.
Well, and we would especially say it of him because there's no evidence of that, you know, bringing fruit in his life throughout the film. And he gets to this point of desperation and then he starts to pray and he kind of tries to guilt trip Chisholm and he says, are you going to kill me in the house of God? You know?
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, yeah, it's kind of like your hatred comes out for him more there, even though he's praying and even though he's, you know, calling down God on this situation, you almost hate him more for it because there's no evidence of it prior in his life.
Well, he's almost
mocking. You don't believe it's sincere. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah,
it's not sincere at all.
Yeah, the religion at that point. Sam, what about you? Like, does most of the God talk in this film really just evaporate? Or were you able to take something away from it?
Yeah, I think for me, it does, largely. I feel like, I don't know if you saw the remake of Ben-Hur this year. Yep. But when Jesus shows up and just speaks scripture, like I feel like it was kind of similar to that in that, you know, I'm watching this movie where and I'm removed one extra step because here in Australia, you know, there's not this such thing as a cultural Christianity or the evangelical world. You know, like it's very much you're a Christian or you're not here. There's no Bible Belt or stuff like that. So I feel like, you know, the town is built around this church. And that's because, you know, the town goes to church together. And so that's why I feel like when the church is this center point of this town and even the point where they got the bell tower to defend the church, or the town from that place, I felt like I found it harder to connect to that a little bit. But then also on top of that, seeing the way in which Sam Chisholm, who, as you mentioned, is kind of the character who we're meant to see as this believer, I didn't see much fruit from him throughout the whole movie, to the point that when it's that final scene, it's just like, well, you know, there's no chance he's going to just let him go and forgive him and whatever. And he says, pray, but there's not one hint that he's going to just go, you know, I forgive you, it's all good. Obviously, because that's disappoint the whole audience. That's not what we want to see. As I mentioned, we all hate Bogue so much. But do you see what I mean? I feel like it's connecting that to cultural Christianity, I think I can look at that and go, look, is he, you know, how genuine is this? And how much am I going to take out of it? Yeah, I don't know.
Well, that's really interesting that you mentioned that there's, you know, there is no cultural Christianity in Australia, and one of my biggest problems living in America is trying to engage culture is cultural Christianity, because you talk to someone about Christ and they go, oh yeah, I'm a Christian, and you're like, kind of like Gene mentioned earlier, like you're like, well, there's really no fruit. So like, maybe you're not, but maybe you are.
Yeah.
So it's really hard to say, like, no, you're not. Telling someone they're not a Christian is very, it's very, very taboo. off limits. You know, like, yeah, I am. I mean, because, yeah, especially in cultural Christianity, it's very difficult to make that case. Because even if you have good evidence on your side, they can basically ignore it because that's what cultural Christianity does. So what I'm curious about is, in cultural Christianity, one of the big things is, confusing, like Gene mentioned earlier, confusing like religion with like politics or capitalism or things like that. And one of those is, I think, blurring the lines between justice and revenge. And we have the Emma Cullen character, particularly, you know, she kind of says that she's looking for justice, but basically is like, I'll settle for revenge. I'm curious, Sam, especially coming from a place where those things probably aren't quite mixed up in religion as much. How is it problematic to get them mixed up? Like what is God's role in justice, and what is God's role in revenge? Like, how are they not the same thing?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Like, I don't know if I can answer that completely, but I mean, I think the way that I like to think about it is that God's actions are right, and he will do what he wants. And if it's up to us or the people of Rose Creek to take justice in their own hands, it's never going to work right. It's never going to be right. Because as you see in this film, she says, I don't seek righteousness, I seek revenge. So that's the catalyst for the whole film. Hundreds of people get shot. All these horses get orphaned and run off into the distance. And you know, like it just shows what a mess it is when we try and do things ourselves. And I think that's still the same way today. I mean, I don't know. I've interviewed a lot of people, a lot of artists and stuff on radio, and especially in America, who say, you know, in God we trust and all this stuff. It's just not really completely true because we're trying to resolve things ourselves. And so, I mean, we don't get it right here in Australia. I don't say that at all. You know, we have a long way to go, and I don't know. It's not when things aren't going to get right until Jesus returns, and that's just the truth of mm-hmm. truth of the Bible, the truth of reality. But I think that's something that really stood out for me in this film. That, you know, if God says, like, if you know, in Romans 12, do not take revenge, but leave room for God's wrath. Mm-hmm. We've got to trust that to him. And that's sometimes a hard truth to read and to take in, because it's like, well, what gives God the right? Well, he is the creator, he's the sustainer, he is our redeemer. And in Jesus, that wrath has been taken. So I don't know. I'm going on a ramble here, but I think that line, it made me think, I don't believe that's anything that a real Christian would say, because of who God is and what he's all about.
And when you say real Christian, I mean, you mean someone who would as best they can be following, like, you know, the tenets of Christianity or the truths of Christianity as they find them in the Bible, not someone who may claim Christianity, but it's more cultural.
Yes, I think that's what I'm trying to say.
Because I know plenty of Christians or people who would say they are Christians. And again, I don't want this to be like sound overly judgy or anything, but I know plenty of Christians. I mean, even today, if we don't take this to, like I say, if you take this to current events, who are more than fine with bloodshed for revenge purposes or what they would call justice purposes.
Mm-hmm.
So when you kind of point it out that way, let's like I said, not get too specific to what's going on right now, but let's keep it to the film. And I think the pushback question that you would have people say, whether it be Christian, culturally Christian or non-Christian, is, okay, so Sam, you're arguing or, you know, positing that God is going to be in charge of wrath and justice. So when what should Emma Cullen be doing if she's a Christian? Like, you know, if she's not trying to.
Well, that's a hard thing to answer, because I'm not saying that any Christian should just stand by and not argue for justice, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that at all. But I just think the way that the film handles the whole thing, even to the point of that last scene where Chisholm's in the church, it just made me feel like, well, where's that real trust and where's the room for forgiveness? Even though, not to excuse what Bogue has done, but it just escalates in a big way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's something here in Australia that's quite different to America, I think, is that here in Australia we've got very good gun laws, so it's illegal to own a gun here. And so often when I watch the news and we hear about shootings in America and all that kind of stuff, it's very easy to just go, what is going on? Where is the where are the laws? Why is this continuing? Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that you feel the same way in many ways. Depending on what your view is on being the right to bear arms and stuff.
Well, like obviously, that. I probably do. I'm not sure Gene does, but that's fine. We can get to what Gene. Yeah.
So I think for me, seeing a film like this, where someone seeks revenge, a whole lot of innocent people get killed in the meantime, and then there's no room for forgiveness at all. I think it impacts me in a way that it's just like, well, really, where's the room for justice, but in a way that is trusting God. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I don't know what that would look like in the Wild West when you've got a bad guy pursuing your town. Yeah. That's so far from what I'm used to. So I don't know.
Well, and I think what's interesting is it seems like there's conflicting messages in the film to me. Again, not that I think there was so much thought put into the film that they go, oh, this is really confusing, and it's gonna, you know, ideologically we're gonna confuse our audience. But like there's this entire thing where, you know, Jack Horn has this line that says, to be in the service of others, with people you respect, I couldn't ask for more than that. And there's this hint of there's something to be said about laying one's life down for one's friends or even strangers. But it seems to be a very problematic message when you're also pushing a might makes right solution. So you're saying at the end of the day, that's nice and all, but it's all about who can kill more people. And we actually see people with the best intentions. And this is what I'm thinking about when you're talking about kind of finding that balance between the right to bear arms and, like, you know, gun laws and stuff. And like I said, I'm not trying to necessarily take a particular stance, but that tension lives when the good guys in this film are actually a cause of more bloodshed than the bad guys are. I feel like that's problematic. That doesn't seem, that makes me uncomfortable, as a Christian, as someone who has hope in something outside, or hope in a justice outside this world. And with that, I say, Gene, thoughts?
Yes, give it to me. So what you identified there and what Jack Horn was saying, I think shows a sense of what they're doing is noble, mm-hmm. that what they're doing is the right thing. They're on the right side of this conflict. And so we have to wonder, why would they think that? To get back to what Ms. Cullen is doing, and Sam, I'm glad you brought up Romans 12 there, because I'm going to go to that. In verse 17, it says, never pay back evil for evil to anyone. So that seems like, okay, her husband was murdered along with some of those townspeople. Their property is being seized and burned and taken from them. That's evil, but she's not to pay it back. And then in the next verse, it says, so far as it depends on you, be at peace with all men. So as much as it depends on her, be at peace with all men. So that's kind of the question. Is it out of her hands at this point? Is there anything she can do to control this scenario, or the whole town, that is, to make peace there? And I think it's very clear at the opening scene that there's nothing they can do. It's out of their hands right now. I think the assembly they had at the beginning in the church is their attempt to make peace. They're talking it out. They're figuring out what they can mm-hmm. do. That's their attempt. And he comes in and blows that out of the water. So in that verse, Sam, that you cited, never take your own revenge, but leave room for the wrath of God. That word wrath there, I think it's really important in connecting it to what Paul goes on to say in chapter 13, because it then goes on to say, you know, be in subjection to the governing authorities. And he goes on in verse 4, he says, if you do what is evil, be afraid for it, talking about the governing authorities there again, it does not bear the sword for nothing, for it is a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. So in chapter 12, we're told to leave room for the wrath of God. And in chapter 13, we're told that the governing authorities are a minister of God who bring wrath on the one who practices evil. So just strictly scripturally speaking here, what Ms. Cullen does by going to Chisholm, I think, is the most most loyal attempt she can make to kind of play this out, because Chisholm is, after all, a justice of the peace. You know, he's got the line in the movie. He says a couple of times he's a justice and, or he keeps the peace in seven states and many territories or something. So he is one of those governing authorities who is charged with being a minister of God who brings wrath on those who practice evil. So he is the right person to go to for this, because also in that town, you have the governing authorities in that town who have been completely overwhelmed. The sheriff there is just a puppet for Bogues. So I think she makes a solid attempt to play out what the scripture is kind of teaching us about the role of governing authorities, specifically keeping the peace here. And you know, where it says this will not bear the sword for nothing, that's talking about using force. I mean, I think that's pretty clear. So from there, I think if we stop there, we say, okay, this is a solid view. Even though she says, I want righteousness, but I'll settle for revenge. Well, we maybe have some problems with that. But for her, getting righteousness in that situation kind of is revenge, because she's uniquely involved with it. Her, you know, her husband was killed. So it is a matter of revenge, but she's giving this over to the proper authorities. Now, he goes on and he seeks, you know, outlaws, people who are not governing authorities, and he does a strong measure of taking matters into his own hands here. And I think we can discuss whether that was the right move, whether that's the right approach. But getting back to what Jack Horn said, the effort, what they're doing there, what they're trying to accomplish, they're trying to free the oppressed from one who is bringing evil upon them. So I think the attempt there is a good one. I think we can say a lot of this lines up with scripture. Now, when you're talking about individual Christians taking matters into their own hands and going outside the law and being a vigilante of sorts, I think then's when we can kind of make a pretty clear case scripturally that, okay, yeah, you're seeking your own revenge here. You're not seeking out God's plan for wrath to be brought on the evildoers. So that's what I would say. And I say that even despite, you know, at the end where he is, where Chisholm is approaching Bogues, and Bogues is very clearly, you know, giving up. You know, that's where forgiveness and mercy comes in. When they're all fighting and attacking, you know, if the seven just stand and preach the gospel there or take no action at all, then the evil continues, the oppression continues. So I think action is necessary there, because the evil is being brought upon them, and they are in a position where they are, scripturally speaking, bringing forth God's wrath on these people. So Mikey, what do you think of that?
I'm just sitting here thinking about how much I disagree with you, but that's okay.
Well, where, man? Talk to me, Mikey.
So this is the thing. This, not that I want to avoid this discussion, but I want to be careful not to get off in too much of a tangent that we don't have reasonable amounts of time to talk about. So I would say the main push that I would have is that when you look at scripture that way, I think you have to ignore a lot more of the Bible to make our part in that a reality. And I think there's a particular mandate that we as individual Christians have. And I think there is a reality that God has set up things in place that are going to act as his justice. And I don't think that we're called to necessarily be a part of it, but realize that it's going to happen. So just because God is going to use the governing authorities does not mean that we necessarily should be the ones to take up arms to do that thing. Which I think is walking a fine line and has a lot of nuance, and there's a lot of anecdotes and nuance to it, which again is why I'm trying to give you like the 30,000 foot view of where we would disagree, because I think it becomes problematic when you put that much hope in justice into only the governing authorities. Because one, I think it shows a lack of faith, kind of like Sam was. You didn't use the phrase lack of faith, but you did raise a question about, like, what does it look like for God's justice to happen, and what does it look like to be faithful to, as Christians, to believe that God is going to bring about justice, whether in, you know, in this life or eternity. And I think it's a worldview that does not have a view of eternity that demands justice in the way that we look for it, especially when it looks like an eye for an eye or something like that. So when you move on from that, I think if you start putting, like I said, you put your hope in those authorities, then in places or countries where the law does not reflect justice very well, hoping for those authorities is actually more detrimental and anti-gospel, which is why I think one of the only things that can actually stop violence or the cycle of violence, because I do believe violence is cyclical, is forgiveness and grace. I think it's the only thing that will actually ever stop violence. And the problem is we tell Christian story, or we tell stories, especially, like, you know, through film and stuff, that are about people who aren't Christian looking for non-Christian ways to solve their problems. And I think justice feels good when it's revenge. And when we need to tell a story that has a beginning, middle, and, like, an end, like a third act, a resolution, which is the one we need to see the resolution, and you're not telling, like, a story where, kind of like Sam says, everything's not going to be right until, you know, Jesus returns and sets things right. We don't have a third act in a lot of Christian stories. I mean, if you tell a story about the early church being thrown to the lions in the Colosseum, you don't have revenge, or you don't have justice.
Certainly not.
You have martyrs. And the only way that you really redeem a martyr story isn't because you went and appealed to Rome to kill the other Romans that are killing them. Like, you have justice because you say, this person dedicated their life to sharing the gospel of Christ to people who were not only either apathetic or antagonistic, but they were murdering people. This person still got justice because they are with Christ in heaven now. Like, that's justice. They got to be with God, the creator of all things, for eternity. And if you talk to someone who doesn't have that view, then they're like, well, that's not really that great. And like I said, there's fear that plays into that. There's pride. There's the understanding of the sovereignty of God. There is the reality that God does shape and form and direct the nations of the earth, and has used in the Old Testament. And, I assume is continuing to use, principalities and, nations now to do some sort of justice, in a temporal fashion. But, I think it's very problematic to look at a film, like, to try to bring it full circle, to look at a film like Magnificent Seven and say, someone whose heart, which is what Christ says, you know, is actually looked at more than almost, anything else, whose heart was for revenge, going to hire people to kill other people. I'm not a big fan of Emma Cullen's decision. And, I can see how you can say that she did basically the best she could, but I also think about when we had one of those great shootings in America where someone took a gun and killed people, you know, and the man went and killed the Amish girls.
Mm-hmm.
And the Amish basically just publicly forgave them, or forgave the man, and that was like, that was more impactful to so many people than having the dude hung on TV or whatever. Like, there's this beauty in forgiveness that you can only really do if you have a worldview that, or a vision of the world that has a picture of eternity as the backdrop.
Right.
Am I off my pedestal yet? I can't tell.
You know, I don't think we disagree as much as it probably seems like, because in those examples you gave, the Roman Colosseum and stuff, the martyrs, they didn't have any representation in the governing authorities in terms of being on God's side, so to speak. So, yes, God set up the governing authorities there, and that's the circumstances that they found themselves in. So there was nothing they could do. So as far as it was on them, they couldn't be at peace, and they had no representative to go to. And they also have the mandate of not taking their own revenge. So the answer there is martyrdom. Now, in the case of the Amish situation you brought up, the people who gave forgiveness, they're existing in a society that does have governing authorities who, again, not perfect, of course, but they, more times than not, they're seeking to deal out wrath on those who do evil. And so most of the time, they're trying to be on the right side of an issue, like what Jack Horn is telling there when he's saying, you know, being in the service of others. So in those two scenarios, you have kind of the two extremes. And I think what we find with Ms. Cullen, the situation she was in, she was somewhat in that the Roman era where there was no one there immediately that could speak up for her, and she wasn't going to do it herself. So she sought out someone to do it for her, someone. And again, I would say you could argue she had some vengeance in mind there, certainly. But she did seek out someone who had authority to bring that punishment to them. So I totally get the forgiveness side of it. Like I said, if you're chiseling there at the end, I think that's when the forgiveness is extended and you just take them into custody and instead of killing them. I still think you have the real life scenario there where the governing authorities are put in place to be serving God's wrath. And when they're not doing that, we can't take our own revenge. But when they do make attempts to do that, I think we're well within our Christian rights to seek out that justice. And it's not a hope that we put in them in an eternal sense, because we're not saying, okay, you doing this secures my salvation or anything. It's a hope we're still putting in God, because we are trusting and hoping that God has set up the government in such a way that it could help us. It could free us from some oppression that we're undergoing. And if it's not, then so be it. We take our lumps, so to speak.
Well, I will add this too. I often hear people arguing against God's justice because they're exalting God's love or God's grace. And I give Tim Keller credit for it, but I know that I think he was quoting someone else when he kind of points out that it takes like the comfort of like the middle class suburbs to believe in a God that is not like 100% justice. And I do not want to ever discuss either the wrath or the justice of God. I don't want to discuss the grace or the love of God to the detriment of his justice.
Right.
Because maybe it doesn't sound like it, but I would say that it's the belief that God not only has perfect love, but he also has perfect justice, that helps shape why I would trust him in the first place. Because, you know, it's like, you know, I feel like there's some phraseology about, you know, the balance between love and truth, like love without truth is like fleeting or doesn't have any teeth, and truth without love is just mean. but you know, Christ and God being both perfect love and perfect truth, give us hard things to hear, but it's always going to be the right and best thing for us.
Yeah.
I say that wanting to know if Sam, you have anything to add.
So Sam, you say there's no guns down there.
sounds like you're a little closer to heaven.
Oh, no way. As I mentioned before, I think that I just struggle to see how taking justice in your own hands and seeking revenge is really going to help anything. And as we saw, so much bloodshed happened in the process. So I feel like who's really the more respectable person here, Bogue or all those who are fighting back with the exact same methods? Anyway, let's not get into it again.
I think it's a great point and something hard to have to wrestle with, which is obviously what we're trying to do, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what happens when the good guys basically don't really look that different from the bad guys?
Mm-hmm.
Well, with that, I think I'll start to wrap us up. And something that I haven't done in a while, but I thought I would do again, is in this particular movie, I was entertained. Like I said, it wasn't a perfect movie. I am sure that when I do have a chance to go back and watch Seven Samurai and The Magnificent Seven from 1960, I'm going to probably enjoy those movies much more than I enjoy this one. But I think this is the way JR put it, in a summer of disappointing blockbusters, this is not by far the worst movie that I've seen. However, there were plenty of things that kind of made me shake my head. So, Sam, I'm wondering if you had a moment or two where you just kind of said, come on. It was just, you know, ridiculous, whether it be a character or a moment, a scene, a line, anything.
I'm trying to remember now. I think, as I mentioned before, though, just how many horses are going to get orphaned? it almost got to the point where it seemed like a running joke, really, that they would just shoot someone and then the horse would be gone. And I don't know. I think that for me was kind of like, come on, like, let's do something else. Also, when they kind of, like, it turned into a bit of a Home Alone kind of booby trap thing as well. Like, I was on board for that, but then you didn't quite know how it was going to work. So, I don't know. There was a few moments like that, I guess.
Maybe we can also, because of that, kind of connect Home Alone back to being influenced by Seven Samurai.
Yeah, of course.
It was really the inspiration.
Well, you did it with Bug's Life. I'm sure it can be done.
Well, I think a Bug's Life is actually, I mean, it gets a lot of press as something that was, anyway, it doesn't matter.
No, I see it.
What are you saying? Get pressed in a bad way?
No. But you know, if you look up, which maybe I had done because of my extensive research for this episode, if you look up like films influenced by Seven Samurai, almost all these lists will list A Bug's Life. Not in like a bad way, but like in a, obviously got this. I mean, this is obviously kind of like an homage to Seven Samurai to some level.
Yeah, right.
So not in a bad way, but yeah.
Yeah.
So Gene, same question, man. What made you say, come on?
Well, my ultimate one, I think I mentioned already, is when I thought we were getting a Jesus juke from Chisholm though, there at the end. He offered to pray with Bogues. But another one I thought of, that it almost was like an awkward moment to me. I felt like it was one of those, like when someone's telling you a joke and they get to the end of it and it's like no one laughs, is when they first came to the city, the town, and they were kind of threatening to shoot him up and everything. And Chris Pratt's character Faraday had this line, and I don't even remember what what was said before, but he said, they'll be killed by the world's greatest lover. And the camera went to him, and he's just standing there. And I'm like, yeah, it was not funny at all. It just fell totally flat, totally flat. Some of those moments where it was like, yeah, that's Andy Dwyer in a cowboy hat, and I'm not buying it. Move on.
See, that's interesting to me because having written scripts, that seems like the line where the writer writes it, and they said, this is going to be the line that everyone just loves, and it falls flat. And it, you know, it's some other line that you didn't even think anyone would care about, like that people end up liking.
Yeah.
So if I had to pick something, the thing that I wanted to be better, because it wasn't that it was terrible or even bad, it's just I wanted it to be better, was the line that Chris Pratt had before he took out the Gatling gun. You know, something about like, I've always had luck with one-eyed jacks or something like that. Like, it wasn't a bad line, but I wanted it to be like the line in the movie.
And I can
barely remember exactly what it was. And like, cause you go through that entire piece where he's getting to the Gatling gun. And I was like, that's the line we got for all that.
Yeah.
I just, like I said, not a bad line. I just wanted it to be better. I wanted it to be more memorable.
Yeah, it was more like, hey, this is funny because remember he's a card player and he does magic tricks. Remember that?
Yeah, and it wasn't even like a card trick that he, or anything really that he'd referenced before, or
yeah,
you know. So yeah. It was, honestly, I think it points to something larger, which is I think one of the very first things that was said in this conversation, which is Sam pointing out that he's forgotten a lot of what happens in the movie. and I think this is not, except for as much fun as it was, I think this is going to go down with most of the movies that I've seen in 2016, which is, that was all right. And then I forget it 2 weeks later.
Well, I've got to say that my wife, Allie, we went to the screening together. And as we were walking out down the cinema stairs, I said, what did you think? And she said, I think that's a forgettable film. And it's totally proven to be the case for all of us, really.
Yeah. I mean, it's still fairly fresh, and I know, Gene, you just saw it for a second time, so it's probably a little more fresh for you. But you know, when I think, like, I'm sure in the throes of summer next year, when I think back about the films that I watched from 2016, I don't think Magnificent Seven, sadly, as big as it was billed, will be something that like comes to mind very quickly. So
yeah, probably not. And I only saw it again because I was worried I was going to forget too much of it. So there you go.
Well, with that, like I said, we've gone about as long as we need to. So I'm going to kind of cut us off generally, but ask again, Sam, is there any final thoughts that you have? Anything that maybe we didn't hit on or you wanted to toss out there?
No, I just think it's interesting. I found it an interesting take on a Western that really didn't have much of a plot. Like, it really, it struck me when I left the film that really there's no story. It's just one guy does a bad thing and everyone fights back. And that's really all that's going on. And as we've discussed it, it touches on spiritual things, but with not a whole lot of depth. So I think that's maybe... That's where I'm coming at it now. Yeah.
No, I think that's fair. Gene, same thing. Anything that we maybe didn't hit on or you just want to let people know about?
Well, I thought there were, from Jack Horn, there were a lot of good lines from him. He's the one, like we mentioned, he's quoting scripture a lot. So I think you could probably look at every scene he's in and look at the scripture he quotes and probably get something from that, whether used appropriately or not. I know there's one time I think he's quoting a psalm or something where when he's stabbing someone through the heart, it's like, okay.
So let's talk about that, Gene.
Yeah, I know. I thought D'Onofrio's voice there was really, really kind of interesting. I really liked it the first time I heard it. And I think I was tweeting with JR about it. I was like, you know, I wonder if that was his choice to do that voice and if it just kind of came out and Fuqua was like, yeah, that works. Do that. Or if it's something that he was directed to do. It's just really interesting because he's this big bear of a guy.
Yeah.
And he's got this funny, high-pitched voice. I totally read somewhere,
or at least I read the headline. I didn't actually read the article. It was one of those, how long is this? It said something like an interview with D'Onofrio about like his character, his motivations in that voice, about how it came to be. And now I have to go find that again.
Okay, cool. No, yeah, the movie as a whole, I had fun watching it. It was a good theater experience. But you know, a year from now, I'm probably not going to remember too much of it. I might, if it's one of those where if it's on TV, I'll stop and watch it. But it may not be one that I go seek out, you know, to purchase or anything.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll say that, I was pleasantly surprised by how much of a Western it was, as opposed to fully embracing like the big budget blockbuster action movie, whatever, a la Wild Wild West or something. Which, I mean, I know that sets the bar really low, but I did have
Practical effects.
There's a lot of movies that I've gone to the theater to see, and I was at least entertained. So I feel like if you understand what you're getting yourself into, you're not going to feel bad that you spent the money to go see the movie. But an Oscar contender, this ain't. Keep that in mind. If you decide, I mean, I guess hopefully if you're listening to this episode, you've already seen the movie. But if you haven't, and you're just listening for fun, then well, thanks. but keep that in mind. If you do go see it, maybe, you know, wait to rent it or something like that. So, I've enjoyed this conversation way more than I thought I would, exactly like the Magnificent Seven. So, you have great conversations because you have great guests. So, Sam, how can people follow what you do, around the web or just anywhere that they can follow the stuff that you do?
You can find me on Twitter at Sam Square Eyes is my handle, and I edit and review at Real, that's REEL-gospel.com, and you can also follow that on Twitter at Real Gospel, REEL-gospel.
Excellent. Gene, same question.
I'm on Twitter at Wizard of Gaz, that's Wizard with no A. I'm an editor and writer on Real World with you, Mikey. So I send my stuff on there. We've got Walking Dead coming up soon. I do the weekly reviews of those episodes. And I'm on the Clear Lens podcast. Me and a couple other guys talk about Christian apologetics. The most recent episode we just recorded last night was about all of the presidential candidates, the three ones that everyone's talking about anyway, and their stances on abortion. We got neck deep in that topic. And then to close that episode, we talked about some general abortion questions as well. And we had a game on that one, and it was a movie trivia game, and I totally cleaned house. Totally.
Well, I was worried for a second when you're like, we just talked about abortion, and then we had a game. I'm like, what kind of game?
Game was beforehand.
two unrelated things.
Right.
Cool.
That's the Clear Lens podcast.
All right. So all the ways to contact and follow these guys, they're great, great work around the web. You know, I mean, obviously I'm a big fan of Real World Theology, but if you haven't noticed, almost every episode that we do, we are linking to Real Gospel because the work they do is really good. Sam and the other writers and editors over there. So follow that stuff. Check out realworldtheology.com where you'll find the show notes for this episode and other episodes. Follow me on Twitter at Fizzification. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast if you've enjoyed it. Again, leave us 5-star reviews. Leave us just written reviews. It helps us so much, helps more people find the podcast, and we'll get more people involved in the conversation. Thank you for the listener for taking time to make this a part of your week, because there are lots of things that you could be listening to. There are lots of things that you could be doing with your time, and you spent some of that with us. So we really appreciate it. Until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. And also remember, Sam, I know you're in Australia. Every time you look up at the moon, I too will be looking at a moon. Not the same moon, obviously. That's impossible. Bye-bye.
Later.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
I really am always interested to hear, like, what does this look like from, you know, not an American's point of view?
Yeah, how dumb do we look?
We think you're crazy, basically. That's it. I just ruined the end of your thing, didn't I? You were on your spiel, and then some whack Australian just decides he needs to come and correct you about science.
Like, of the three of us, people are like, I really like what Sam had to say about it.
Yeah.
So
I am patriotic, but I was not offended.